next speaker is going to be Douglas Green. He's an independent communist historian living in the Boston area. He is the author of an upcoming book called Spectres of Communism, Lenke and Marx, coming from Haymarket Books, and his paper is called At the Crossroads of Lenkeism and Leninism. Thank you.
Thank you. Ironically, this talk deals with none of what was in the book, so it deals with the period afterwards. So I will not actually be getting into a what-if scenario, though I'm happy to continue that, because it's just fascinating to discuss. But since this whole conference is about the legacy of Blanqui along with the man as well, the movements of the next century, the 20th century, those many of which are inspired by the Russian Revolution, they have to deal with that legacy of the 19th century revolutions such as Blanquism. And, well, Rosa Luxemburg once said that Bolshevism is nothing more than the mechanical transposition of the organizational principles of Blanquism into the mass movement of the socialist working class. Now, many share Luxemburg's position that Leninism is elitist and or Blanquist, but for Lenin, Blanquism was something that the communist movement needed to overcome if they wanted to win a successful socialist revolution. Leninism is not simply Blanquism or Jacobinism adapted to Russian conditions, but the development of a Marxist mode of politics that draws its lessons from the defeat of the Paris Commune and Blanquism. The central operator of the Leninist mode of politics is a revolutionary vanguard party dedicated to the emancipation of the working class and the peasantry. However, there does remain a grain of truth in the accusation that Leninism is Blanquist, since Blanquism is a label often used by revisionists to condemn the revolutionary essence of Marxism. To begin, what exactly is Blanquism? And the central figure, of course, is Blanqui, the consummate professional revolutionary and man of action. He is one of, as we know, one of the loudest and most compromising voices in 19th century France, who preached class war and the violent overthrow of capitalism. And as we all can probably agree, he did mean it. From 1830 through 1870, he organized many secret societies and participated in multiple revolutions. Yet the only method open to Blanqui was an elite and tight-knit conspiracy that would strike capital at the appointed hour to bring about communism. And of course, he fails each and every time. And he pays the price for that failure by spending half of his life in jail. And his eagerness to rush into battle caused him to act oftentimes before the time was right. In 1848 and 1870, premature action led him to be locked up before crucial events such as the June Days and the Paris Commune. Blanqui did not see the need for a developed theory to grasp the inner dynamics of capitalism, nor did he appreciate the possibilities open to mass independent political action by the working class to bring about revolutionary change. It would be Marxism that would develop the necessary theory of capitalist dynamics and grasp the centrality of mass politics. And ultimately, Marxism would supplant Blanquism in the aftermath of the Paris Commune in new mass socialist parties. Now, although Blanqui does terrify the French ruling class and the along with the proletariat uprisings of the 19th century, especially the Commune, these were more forebringers of a new mode of politics. The working class was developing new mass organizations such as trade unions and independent political parties to coordinate their struggle on both an a national and an international level. The Paris Commune was not simply a repeat of the Great French Revolution, but it was also, in many respects, a proletariat revolution that demonstrated a new mode of political organization whereby the working class created a new state that smashed the old repressive one and allowed them to be truly in control of society by instituting sweeping measures to supplant the old bourgeois society. And according to Marx, the Commune was essentially a working class government, the product of the struggle of the producing against the appropriating classes, the political form at last discovered under which to work out the economical emancipation of labor. Yet the Commune suffered from a number of faults which caused it to be defeated. For one, arguably it neglected to launch a decisive military offensive. Secondly, the Commune was isolated from the peasantry in other major cities of France. Thirdly, the Commune lacked a centralized leadership behind an organization goal and program. And in learning from the failure of the Commune, revolutionaries needed to learn what to do differently to prevail. And it would be Lenin and the Bolsheviks who would provide probably one of the most compelling answers to that question. However, Bolshevism was not just responding to the failure of Blanquism and the Commune. but also to Second International Marxism. So within a generation of Blanqui's death, massive and at least nominally revolutionary parties would gain millions of members and bring substantial reforms. And to the Second International, Marxism was often interpreted as a crude deterministic theory of social evolution focused narrowly on the working class, largely neglecting other oppressed layers and classes. Now, according to this version of orthodox Marxism, capitalism would steadily develop, expand the productive forces, and inevitably be replaced by socialism. And all socialist parties generally had to do was wait patiently for the promised future. In this gradualist conception, revolutionary praxis and politics were relegated to the background. Indeed, even the orthodox Marxist Kolkotsky defined a socialist party as a revolutionary party, but is not a party that makes revolutions. This conception left Marxism at an impasse, doomed to passivity, with only a vision of incremental reformist progress and avoiding revolutionary breaks. Some socialists, such as Edward Bernstein, sought to update Marxism to match this trend by turning socialism into a reform movement. Interestingly, Bernstein's revisionism targeted the supposed Blanquism inherent within the Marxist dialectic. And he says, in Germany, Marx and Engels, working on the basis of the radical Hegelian dialectic, arrived at a doctrine very similar to Blanquism. Blanqui remained a revolutionary phantom who haunted many revisionists and reformists. They sought to exorcise all elements of Blanquism from Marxism in order to justify their abandonment of revolution, communism, and acceptance of the capitalist order. And the end result of Second International reformism, as we know so well, was not an easy reformist path to socialism, but support for their ruling classes in World War I. Now, Lenin saw the need to surmount the reformist and passivity of Marxism of the Second International. However, Blanquism was not a revolutionary answer for Lenin. These two trends needed to be replaced with the primacy of revolutionary politics. And in developing a new Marxist mode of politics, Alain Badiou identifies the four lessons which Lenin drew from the defeat of the Commune. And it's a long quote. One, it is necessary to practice Marxist politics, not some local romantic revolt, whether workist or populist. The profound meaning of what is to be done, Lenin's famous work, is entirely contained in this difficult and original call. Let us be absolutely and irrevocably political activists. And two, it is necessary to have an overall view of things in the national framework at least, and not be fragmented into a federalism of struggles. Three, it is necessary to forge an alliance with the rural masses. And four, it is necessary to break the counter-revolution through an uninterrupted military offensive centralized process. In addition to these four points, Badiou states a fifth one, the Vanguard Party, which he says was the operator of the concentration of these four requirements. And now let us turn to each of these five requirements in order to distinguish Leninist politics from those of both Blanquism and the Second International. So the first one would be that of the Tribune, which although in the political conditions of 19th century France and Tsarist Russia necessitated underground organization by revolutionaries, both Blanqui and Lenin took far different approaches on how to organize. Blanqui envisioned that each member of his conspiracy would operate underground, trained in the use of conspiratorial methods, and ready to strike on the appointed day. This was not necessarily the case with Lenin. Lenin stressed that party members did need a certain sense of professionalism, knowing how to organize in the underground, but the party was not to be cut off from the masses. Rather, the ideal party member envisioned was a tribune of the people, who not only inspires the masses of workers, but attacks every manifestation of capitalist cruelty and portrays the bigger picture of national and international struggle. And the Revolutionary Party was not a simple workers' party, but was linked with other layers in society. Now, praxis, Lenin believed that a tribune of the people needed a political and revolutionary theory that would provide an understanding of the contradictions of society and the role of different classes. And this theory was to be found in Marxism, devoted to the class struggle and changing the world. If a professional revolutionary was to act as a tribune of the people and link all these struggles, they needed a method of analysis to comprehend them in their totality. And Lenin said, without revolutionary theory, there can be no revolutionary movement. For Lenin, there was no division between theory and practice. As the revolutionary Victor Serge, during at least one of his Leninist period, said, Lenin's thought is action. There is no divorce in Lenin between thought and action. And all of Lenin's thought had that single aim, to bring about the revolution. And George Lukács, the Hungarian communist, in his study of Lenin, said the actuality of revolution, this is the core of Lenin's thought and his decisive link with Marx. Now, as opposed to Kautsky and the Second International, Lenin saw Marxism as a philosophy of action. For Lenin, the dialectics of revolutionary Marxism, the ability to analyze and adapt to the rapids of reality, allows him to see the line of march and to prepare for it. He can see the contradictions emerging, bubbling over, and through studies he can see the possibilities that present themselves while others remain blind to them. For example, after the overthrow of the Tsar in 1917, many revolutionaries actually supported the provisional government, such as Stalin. Yet Lenin saw the February Revolution couldn't successfully wage war and satisfy the demands of the masses, and he believed that the development of imperialism had placed socialism on the historical agenda. Now, while Blanqui did emphasize the need for organization, there is no corresponding theory, with certainly the depth of Marxism, to analyze social contradictions, identify allies, plan strategy, etc. And his method of organization did not rely on the masses, but was divorced from them. None of this mattered to Blanqui, who believed it was just the duty to struggle. And in the end, Blanqui struck when conditions were not ripe. He relied on failed methods of struggle, which produce only a tragic hero and not a successful revolution. For Blanqui, revolution was only to be organized in major urban centers like Paris, and cadres were drawn principally from middle-class intellectuals, artisans, and workers. And the vast masses of peasants were not a revolutionary force, but a single reactionary mass. Blanqui's disdain for the peasantry as a conservative class was shared by many, although not say all, parties of the Second International. Although Lenin, in was seeing the peasantry as a major ally of the proletariat in the revolutionary process for a number of reasons. When Lenin concluded that the forthcoming Russian Revolution was a bourgeois democratic one with demands such as a republic, 8-hour day, land reform, etc., this did not, and this is in 1905, this did not mean he believed that the bourgeoisie would lead this revolution. The bourgeoisie was too cowardly, tied to czarism, and they feared upheaval from below. He expected the bourgeoisie to make some kind of, to rally to czarism. Lenin, in fact, argued for a sweeping and thoroughgoing revolution, which he said is one of rapid amputation, which is the least painful to the proletariat, the path of the immediate removal of the least compliance, and with the so pretty much wiping the slate clean. According to Lenin, only the proletariat was a consistently democratic force who would tear down the edifice of czarism and feudalism. But for the proletariat to play this role, it needed the support of the peasantry, and these two classes together would accomplish the revolution. And during the bourgeois phase of the revolution, Lenin believed that the proletariat and the peasantry would march together. Now, the peasantry was had small proprietors, and many owned small enterprises. They were stratified, disunified, and they had an attachment to private property. And many wealthier peasants would resist any march to socialism. Still, Lenin was willing to struggle with the whole peasantry against czarism during the bourgeois phase. But during the socialist revolution, the proletariat would be allied with the poor and semi-proletariat section of the peasantry. And this did not necessarily work out quite that way, but there was some truth to it. There was something to it in 1917 when the Bolsheviks did champion the demands of the peasantry. Now, whether other socialists, such as the Mensheviks, socialist revolutionaries, cooperated often with the bourgeoisie because Russia was supposedly not ripe for socialism, Lenin did see the possibilities that the situation presented if the workers allied with the peasantry. Ultimately, Lenin was able to build a counter-hegemonic force of workers and peasants with communist politics in command who did take power. And Lenin, quoting Marx, said, the whole thing in Germany, Marx looking back on what Germany needed in that forthcoming revolution, will depend on the possibility of backing the proletariat revolution by some second edition of the peasant war. Then the affair will go splendid. The development of a counter-hegemonic bloc of the exploited and oppressed under communist and revolutionary leadership will be a key component in the successful revolutions of the 20th century. Lenin never rejected the need for revolutionaries to fight for reforms, but he does believe that a revolution can come about, does not believe that a revolution can come about peacefully. And contrary to many in the Second International, he does not believe the state is a neutral apparatus, but is an organ of class rule. Now, Lenin does follows Marx in his study of the commune, that the proletariat needs to smash the bourgeois state and build a new one based on the people in arms. And Lenin argued that the Soviets produced by the Russian Revolution were the equivalent of the Paris Commune. Lenin's conception of an armed revolutionary seizure of power differs fundamentally from that of Blanquism. The whole theory and practice of Lenin ran against the Blanquist belief that that power could be seized by a small conspiratorial group. Lenin summarized the difference between the Marxist and the Blanquist conceptions of revolution as follows, and so another long quote. Marxists are accused of Blanquism for treating insurrection as an art. Can there be any more flagrant perversion of the truth? Well, not a single Marxist will deny that it was Marx who expressed himself on this score in the most definitive, precise, and categorical manner, referring to an insurrection specifically as an art, saying that it must be treated as an art, that you must win the first success and then proceed from success to success, never ceasing the offensive against the enemy, taking advantage of his confusion, etc. To be successful, insurrection must not rely not upon conspiracy and not upon a party, but upon the advanced class. That is the first point. Insurrection must rely upon a revolutionary upsurge of the people. That is the second point. Insurrection must rely upon the turning point in the history of the growing revolution, when the activity of the advanced ranks of the people is at its height, when the vacillations in the ranks of the enemy and in the ranks of the weak, half-hearted, etc., are of the revolution are at their strongest. That is the third point. And these three conditions for raising the question of insurrection distinguish Marxism from Blanquism. Once these conditions exist, however, to refuse to treat insurrection as an art is a betrayal of Marxism and a betrayal of the revolution. End quote. And the need to treat insurrection as an art was shared, of course, by Blanqui, Lenin, and Trotsky, who all thought seriously about the conquest of political power. Lenin and Trotsky understood the importance of studying the terrain of engagement and careful planning, in contrast to a fatalistic approach. However, the need for planning and conspiracy to take power did not necessarily mean that the Bolsheviks were acting like Blanquists. As Trotsky argues, planning for insurrection cannot be done directly by the working class, but some form of mediation was necessary. And he says, just as a blacksmith cannot seize the red-hot iron in his naked hand, so the proletariat cannot directly seize the power. It has to have an organization accommodated to the task. Now, while Lenin and Trotsky agreed with Blanqui that it was necessary to carefully plan, learn the terrain, and be ready to strike, the similarities end. Blanqui was willing to strike as soon as his conspiracy was perfected, not after the sharpening of societal contradictions and the emergence of a favorable moment. By contrast, the Bolsheviks had a much more flexible strategy. While Lenin stressed the need for careful planning, he understood that a party had to be flexible. The party needed practice, initiative, daring. Otherwise, they would be paralyzed by immobility and passivity. Lenin didn't neglect the technical side of the insurrection, and he argued that the masses needed to be more organized in order to so that they could catch the enemy off guard, and when the time came to strike, to treat insurrection as an art. Lenin stressed the need for a centralized command, the seizure of strategic points in the capital, and movement against leaders of the government, army, etc. Blanqui often lacked flexibility and codified his ideas on insurrection. He only possessed a very single means of insurrection, which was a push, which needed to be put into action. He could not account for chance or accidents in war. He could not grasp what a Prussian general, Moltke, understood so well. No plan of operations extends with certainty beyond the first encounter with the enemy's main strength. Blanqui did not possess this flexibility in his conception of warfare to perceive the need that strategy needed to be far more fluid. Although insurgents needed an overall plan of battle, he did not grasp a further dictum of Moltke that strategy is a system of expedients. While no plan of battle could account for unforeseen contingencies, this did not mean that planning was to be discarded. Rather, planning needed a critical method of analysis and adaptability, which Blanqui lacked. While Blanqui understood a great deal of military use of barricades during insurrection, He only understood the social utility of them in a far more limited sense. While Blanqui had practical experience in urban insurrection, he did not take into account technical adaptations and social control measures on a part of the state that made the barricade ineffective as a military tactic. Lenin and Blanqui agreed that the working class cannot rely upon the bourgeoisie, reformist, or other forces to make a revolution, but needs its own independent political organizations. Lenin knew that one of the mistakes of the commune is it lacked a single organization, and it is the vanguard party in the Leninist conception of politics that puts into action, by linking the demands of the masses to an overall exposure of capitalism with the goal of the seizure of power. The party cannot achieve its goals if it acts in a disorganized and decentralized manner. According to Lenin, the party needs discipline. This discipline relies upon democracy under centralized leadership. There is, according to Lenin anyway, there is freedom of discussion and elections with higher bodies selected and subjected to control from their base. Not necessarily always put into practice, but in theory anyway. But once there is a democratic decision, that decision is binding and there's unity in action. Now, Lenin recognized that a party could not foresee all events, and it would often be some unknown fire or spark that could provoke a revolution. His own study of dialectics in Hegel during World War I emphasized often sudden leaps, interruptions that can change a situation. Paradoxically, it's true that no plan of battle survives contact with a revolutionary event. The party has the ability to systematically plan, will be able to lead a revolution to victory. For Lenin, a revolutionary party which is able to plan well using the methods of Marxism will be better able to respond to the turns and unknown events which erupt. Now, on the one hand, Lenin understood when spontaneous outbreaks of struggle occurred that a party lagged behind the masses. But on the other hand, he recognized the spontaneous struggle would not be enough to bring about socialism. A centralized force was necessary. No doubt Lenin would have agreed. Now, the whole mode of Lenin's politics, from his studies of dialects to forging an alliance with the peasantry to development of a military policy, would be simply academic without the instrument of the party. If Lenin had relied on Blanqui's methods of organization in 1917, then there would have been no seizure of power. Lenin's vision of a party is the operator of Marxist politics. It's here where theory and practice are united in a vehicle for changing the world. As Lukács says, the Leninist party concept represents the most radical break with the mechanistic and fatalistic vulgarization of Marxism. It's, on the contrary, the practical realization both of its genuine essence and its deepest intent. The philosophers have only interpreted the world in different ways. The point, however, is to change it. Now, what remains, in my view, that one of the most propagated myths of the Bolshevik Revolution, that it was a coup d'etat, and often that the Bolsheviks were Russian Blanquists. And even though sympathetic to both Blanquism and Bolshevism, as Blanqui's main biographer repeat the claim, the liaison between Babufism and Bolshevism by way of revolutionary Marxism is realized, so to speak, through Blanquism. Thereby, Blanquism is linked not just to Bolshevism, but all the way back to the first communists, modern communists from the French Revolution. Although the whole of this talk has argued that there's actually quite a big gap that separates Lenin from Blanquism. But there's a grain of truth to the accusation that the October Revolution was Blanquist. And in contrast to the Second International, reality proved that the struggle between opposing classes could not be reconciled peacefully. It was either rule or ruin. And every revolutionary, whether Blanqui or Lenin, if they were serious, need to think earnestly about the conquest of power. And for all his faults, Blanqui was ahead of many by stressing the need for the conquest of power. He knew that revolution required organization, planning, and sacrifice. There was no socialism through peaceful reforms or the ballot box. The socialism of Bernstein and the revisionists was not one of leaps, action, or breaks in the fabric of history. The socialism of the revisionists was one of inevitable that could be passively awaited like a morning dawn. This socialism was foretold in the Science of Marxist texts that were drained of their content and turned into dogma. The socialism of the reformers and revisionists is one that would never come. When Lenin heard social democrats in 1905 proclaim that they were opposed to guerrilla warfare and armed struggle, because they're against anarchism and Blunkism, he's declared, do these people realize what they're saying? When I see a social democratic theoretician or publicist not displaying regret over this unpreparedness, but rather a proud smugness and self-exalted tendency to repeat pages by rote about anarchism and Blancism, I am hurt by this degradation of the most revolutionary doctrine in the world. Lenin's criticism is not that workers are resorting to armed struggle, but that the workers were not prepared to organize enough to ensure victory. The grain of truth in the identification of Blancism and Leninism is that they shared a certain understanding of common sense, that socialism would not come through utopias, appealing to the ruling class, or reforms, but would take action and power. The International's Second International's condemnation of the October Revolution as Blancism is not necessarily because they hate elitism, conspiracy, illegality, or violence. They had no problem supporting World War I, or from, in Germany, using death squads to murder communists. Rather, they deny the right of the proletariat to deprive the bourgeoisie of power. In other words, they are on the other side. Ultimately, social democratic revisionists who condemn Lenin Trotsky for their Blancism under the banner of Marxism is because they don't want a Marxist politics, which is revolutionary. And if that is Blancism, then so much the better. And initially, the Soviet Union upheld Blanqui against his reformist detractors. The Comintern's 1928 Manual for Armed Insurrection actually spoke to Blanqui semi-favorably. But the Soviet Union, as its revolutionary energies were exhausted, grew more conservative and sought accommodation and peaceful coexistence. And talk of insurrection became either a nuisance or an embarrassment. And the communist parties throughout the world would often condemn any armed struggle, any independent action as Blancist or ultra-leftist. By contrast, socialists and communists in both the Second Internationals, down to revolutionaries through our own time, have taken Blanqui seriously. While the weaknesses of Blanqui were never denied or minimized, he was upheld for his rejection of determinism and recognition of the radical openness of history, the willingness to struggle, etc. Yet when the revisionists condemned revolutionaries for Blancism, it was not to attack his vices, but his virtues. As Trotsky declared, the revisionists labeled the revolutionary content of Marxism with the word Blancism, the more easily to enable them to fight against Marxism. So, to just briefly recapitulate, Lenin, I would say, can only be called a Blancist in the sense that he was a revolutionary who seriously considered the question of power. What he developed was a new mode of revolutionary politics in response to the failures of Blancism and the Second International. And unlike Blanqui, he was actually able to make a revolution that did take power. What happened afterwards is probably a discussion left for another time.